This is Amy, and I teach second, third, and fourth grade science in Dallas. Welcome to School of Practice on Edutopia Radio.
You gotta slow down to move kids forward.
That's Beck Alber. She spent 10 years teaching high school ELA. Now she mentors first-year teachers in UCLA's Graduate School of Education. And she's talking about her approach to scaffolding and why it's so important for learning.
If I don't slow down and illuminate content for my students, then we're just playing school. And then at the end, I say, did you get it? And they all nod and we move on. And then I give some sort of assessment and they didn't get it.
I'm Kristen Leong, an editor at Edutopia, and I'm also a former middle school ELA teacher. No matter what subject or level you teach or how long you've been in the classroom, breaking down learning into bite-sized pieces is an essential skill. But when was the last time you stopped to think about which scaffolds you rely on and how well they work? Today, Beck will walk us through a smart set of strategies that she has honed over three decades in education. We'll talk about pre-teaching vocab, modeling, discussions, tapping into background knowledge, and how to make the best use of multimodal scaffolding. Plus, Beck will explain how you can tell if your scaffolding is actually working, what to do when it's not, and how to help older students learn how to choose or create their own scaffolds. Okay, let's get into it. Okay, Beck, so experienced teachers know what scaffolding is, but let's just start by defining it really quickly here at the outset.
So scaffolding is breaking down learning into steps with a lot of intentionality. You know where you want them to end up, your learners. You're going to be thinking of all the ways you can illuminate and amplify, check for understanding.
And there's a huge impact when scaffolding is done well, right? Advanced learners who may more quickly grasp the material will have more durable memories, and students who need more support will feel less overwhelmed.
Yes. I would say you start with scaffolding for the whole group, knowing your whole group of learners, you put in the scaffolds, and along the way, you're going to differentiate for students where the scaffolds are not enough. Now, if you find that the whole class is struggling, then that means you need to stop and reteach and revisit your scaffolds. You know, I've been in the middle of a lesson and I just stopped and I said, you know what? Let's go back to working on that draft in our notebooks. And I'm going to rethink this, or we're going to save this till Monday. And shifting. It's so important for teachers in those moments not to personalize it. Oh, I worked so hard on this planning. Mm-hmm. You know, all kinds of things go through our heads, but it's important to get curious. Those are moments for you to pause, check for understanding. And I think it's important for teachers to give themselves permission to stop in the middle of a lesson and just give them a little brain break for you to just think for a moment about how you want to redirect. You know, searching for a short clip on a concept that just is not landing with them. Look, here's a 3-minute video on that very idea. We're going to watch that right now.
I really like that point you made about if there's more scaffolding needed, if you need to pause in a lesson or a unit and go back and do more explaining, that is not a personal reflection of your teaching. And I think when I think back to when I was a new teacher, that was something I had to learn, that if the kids need more instruction, need more clarity, that doesn't mean that you didn't teach the lesson well or you didn't set the lesson up correctly. It just means your students need more information.
Exactly.
And now, what are some of the most common challenges that experienced teachers face with scaffolding?
We get stuck using the same scaffolds. I'm going to use this strategy for previewing the text. I'm going to use these sentence frames. And we kind of get stuck in our way of doing things, right? It's very human to do that. So one of the things we want to do as experienced teachers is think about a product that you had students make. Let's say you've been teaching for 8 years and you're like, you know, it comes out pretty weak. Well, that is a great opportunity for an experienced teacher to say, what new scaffolds or different scaffolds do I need to put in? Another piece of advice I'd say for experienced teachers, Go observe or collaborate with a colleague who you haven't worked with before. See what they're doing for their scaffold. See how they're keeping lessons fresh, because we can always be learning from each other and with each other.
Now, scaffolding poses different challenges for new teachers. You mentor first-year teachers and you're in the classroom observing them all the time. What aspects of scaffolding do you see them struggling with the most?
I would say they don't slow down enough because they have a lot of pressure. We're only staying in this unit for 4 weeks. So you got to hustle and you got to cover these readings and get them to the culminating project. So they feel very beholden to that. Here's what happens a lot, right? Does anyone have any questions? Nope. Okay, let's go.
Right. And how can you tell if your scaffolding isn't working? What should you look for?
Younger students will tell you, I don't get it. They may even cry. I mean, they advocate for themselves a lot more. Mm. You get into secondary and what kids do is they shut down or act out. I'm bored. This is stupid. Mm. I hate this class. To me, that's all really important data because it's you've left them in the dust. You haven't put a step in thinking that they have a shared understanding of this concept.
After the break, we'll walk through Beck's go-to scaffolding strategies. Plus, she'll tell us how to get a good mix of scaffolding modalities in play and how to make sure your toolkit isn't getting stale. Okay, be right back.
Hi, it's Tom from the Edutopia team. Have you ever thought about writing for Edutopia? If you're ready to share what's working in your classroom or school community, our Write For Us page has everything you need to get started. You'll find clear guidance on the kinds of stories we publish, sample pitches, and tips straight from editors like me to help you craft something great. Your story could be the one that sparks change for another educator. Visit edutopia.org and search Write For Us to get started.
Okay, Beck, let's get into your scaffolding strategies, starting with one that should be used before a lesson, pre-teaching new vocab. Now, background knowledge is really important. We'll talk more about that later, but I want to quickly share something our research editor, Yuki Terada, says. Tackling a new topic without sufficient background knowledge is like exploring a cave without a flashlight. So when kids are missing key vocab, they are really at a huge disadvantage compared to peers who can draw from a stronger vocabulary. What are your tips for pre-teaching new words without just having kids look them up and write out definitions?
I want to be very strategic about the words I choose. I always tell my students, of every unit, choose 7 to 10 words that you truly want your students to own.
7 to 10 words. This is
seven
a good
to
note.
10 words. Mm-hmm. They're going to play with those words through the unit. You might even use them in the directions for activities they're doing. You're going to use them verbally. You're going to challenge them to go home and use a word.
Post them on a word wall, have them visually around the room.
Exactly. So the goal is by the end of the unit, they are near application of those words. They've played around. They've had multiple exposures.
And how do you choose those 7 to 10 words?
These are words that they're familiar with or have heard, but they don't feel confident enough to use in their writing or their speaking yet.
And I know you suggest several different ways of practicing that vocab. One method is visual. You bring in photos of the words, or you invite the kids to create a symbol or a drawing for each word. Tell us how these activities work in class.
Those words you know you want the students to own, you want to introduce them in a really splashy way. So you want to have some images, even a little video, and then you allow the students to have some time to process those words. And you can do that with what's called the Frère model.
Right. And that's a really simple 4-square grid. We'll include a link in the show notes with more info on the Frère model. Now, you note that it's important to find ways to connect what students are learning to their own lives. And this is especially important when you're introducing a new lesson or book. Can you give me some examples of how you do this?
You know, if you think about photosynthesis, if you just taught elementary age students about photosynthesis and did it textbook style, how would that transfer versus showing them a little video and then asking them, what have you seen, you know, in your home? Do you have houseplants in your home? Letting them share what they have seen and experienced. When you do go to the textbook and you start to learn the scientific specifics about photosynthesis, then they'll be able to say, make those connections. And you as a teacher can say, oh, remember Jessica shared how her grandmother always puts the plants by the window in the morning.
Okay, we've talked about how to pre-teach vocabulary and tap into prior knowledge. Now, modeling an activity at the outset is another great way to scaffold new material. Basically, you're demonstrating exactly what they are expected to do before they do it. Why is this important?
I think as new teachers sometimes, and maybe as tired, experienced teachers, sometimes we fall into just telling students what they're going to do. You know, if we want them to write a really dynamic introductory paragraph to their argumentative essay, we want to show them what that looks like and give them a couple examples. And then I want to say this, there's so much stuff online, of course, and you could find 10th grade examples, you know, or whatever grade you're teaching. And we have to be careful doing that because we want to make sure whatever that writing is, that it fits the rubric or criteria of what you have your kids doing.
That's a perfect segue to my next question. When you're introducing that new lesson, that new unit, and you're sharing that mentor text at the beginning, are you also at the same time sharing the rubric with the grading criteria?
Typically, yes. And I would say that's something you do in the first week. Here's what we're working towards, students. This is our goal. In 5 weeks, we're going to start working on this, or 3 weeks. Here's the criteria, here's the piece of writing. And you give the kids time to look at that and see in tandem, you know, those two things, how they are connected. So they could look and see the criteria and then see evidence of that in the product.
Now, if you're modeling your thought process as you read or solve a math problem, think alouds can be a great option. First, how do you prep for this? Are you identifying spots to pause and think out loud in advance?
Always. You want to read it first, just as a reader, and then you want to read it as a teacher with your specific students in mind, with the end task in mind for that lesson. Also, as teachers, remember, we are gleaning from our prior knowledge, our beliefs, our experiences while we read. And when you're doing a think aloud and you go, oh, I can't believe she said that, you're modeling for your students how to do it as well.
And if you're modeling group discussions, another great option is a fishbowl discussion. We'll link to a great video that Edutopia made about this strategy in our show notes. Now, you also note that it's important to give students time to process new material. We know that structured discussions are a great way of doing that across grade levels. Two common examples of this type of scaffold are think, pair, shares and turn and talks. And it's important to have guiding questions that clarify the new material and connect it to what students have already learned. Can you give us a few examples of good guiding questions so we can hear how they sound?
The way I like to see it is you're setting them up for a reading mission.
Ah.
In a chunk. So it's a reading mission, right? A lot of times we'll read, here we are, I'm the teacher, I'm reading, boom, 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 or read the three paragraphs and I say, what just happened? What do you think is going to happen next? It's better to say, I'm about ready to read these three paragraphs. We already know this about Diana. She's not to be trusted. I want you to tell me what she does, what she says or doesn't say, and what that tells us of who she is as a person.
So we're not going to say, what do you find interesting about this? And the goal is that they're engaged into the text. No, it's a specific connection. So we're going to follow Diana's character development. So how does Diana evolve in this section, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've just talked about modeling and using guided discussions to scaffold learning. Let's get a little visual now and talk about graphic organizers and other visual aids. These can help kids organize thoughts, map out ideas, and demonstrate their relationships between concepts. So Beck, what advice do you have for incorporating graphic organizers and anchor charts as scaffolds without over-relying on them?
Don't be too married to the graphic organizer being completed. Here's an example. A student's working on a graphic organizer and they say, can't I just start writing?
I'm ready. And we say, no, you have to finish your graphic organizer because it's worth 10 points.
Would you go as far as to say graphic organizers should never or rarely be graded?
Yes. If a student, if a learner has filled out 2/3 of it and they're like, I want to write my story, they're ready, full credit. Now, you might have a kid say, I'm ready, and they start writing and they're not. That's where we get to redirect them back to the graphic organizer, and maybe we put a sentence frame in that box where they're stuck.
I want to pivot now and talk about using metacognitive tasks as scaffolds. We know that metacognitive questions give students a template for interrogating new material, which puts them on the path to becoming independent learners. And we heard from another educator in our Edutopia community who asks her middle schoolers to choose or create their own scaffolds. Her name is Cara Duma, and she has more than 20 years of experience teaching ELA and special ed. Here's how her strategy works.
When you're introducing a task, you might ask them, remember what you've used in the past. What do you think might work best for you now? And then invite them to choose or create a scaffold that they think would help them.
I love giving kids some choice in how they scaffold their learning. And it's also important that students develop their own strategies for managing new information. Prepping question prompts for students to ask themselves have been great in my experience. For example, what stands out to me about this new material? Or how does this connect to what I already know? Beck, is there anything else you would add to that?
It sounds like this teacher also has a repository of scaffolds and has surfaced those to all of them so they know where they can go to choose a scaffold. And I would just say, and she would probably say this too, there's a sweet spot for how many to give a kid, right? To me, 3 is the magic number, keeping that not overwhelming.
Yep. Now, I want to close by talking about how to assemble a basic toolkit of scaffolding strategies. Do you have advice on how many and what types of strategies should be in that mix?
I think having a handful, doing those well, and for experienced teachers, what can you add? How can you freshen up that pool of scaffold strategies and activities that you do, right? Like you have the ones you do, go visit a colleague and observe and pick up some new ideas. Try an app or a website, you know, turn to technology. I love Diffit because it will abridge text, but it also will produce graphic organizers for a specific task. I would just say, don't change everything at once. I actually had a literacy instructor tell me when I was like a first or second year teacher, if you add one good new strategy per year, you're doing great.
And how should teachers be thinking about a good mix of modalities in their scaffolding toolkit?
You want to remember that you have different kinds of learners in the room. You know, if some students in the room are writing using sentence stems, you may allow another student or give them an opportunity to express their understanding by creating a symbol or an image or even through talking with you.
So what this really is mixing up different kinds of sensory scaffolding for kids. For example, pairing a written or verbal lesson with pictures or video, or maybe even asking students to act out a historical event. The kids are learning it through different sensory experiences, so the learning is stickier because they're experiencing the lessons in different ways. This is a perfect example of multimodal learning, right?
Yeah, you're going deeper. And then also if you're varying it, then when you do turn and talks or they are co-constructing understanding and knowledge together in small groups or in pairs, they're going to have a lot more to say and share with their fellow students.
And what are the signals teachers should be looking for? How do you know when it's time to mix up your modalities and try something new?
I think just through observational data, if they're stuck and they're not moving forward or they're shutting down and they're just getting distracted and off task, those are indicators for us as teachers that we need to mix it up. We need to try something else.
Here are 3 things I'm taking away from this conversation. 1. If you're a new teacher, the success of your scaffolds really depends on knowing where your students are in their learning. So it's important to find ways to quickly get to know your class as a whole, as well as your individual students. And remember, it is okay to slow down and add a step. 2. If you're an experienced teacher, you probably have a few go-to scaffolds. but it's important to vary your strategies and keep them refreshed. Try to add one new scaffolding strategy each year. To get new ideas, you can observe a colleague or try new tech tools like Diffit to give your graphic organizers an instant makeover. And three, if you work with older students, you might try Cara Duma's approach and have them make or choose their own scaffolds for different tasks. Beck suggests offering three options. The idea is to help students understand how they learn and what they need to be successful. In other words, building that metacognitive muscle every chance you get. Special thanks to Beck Alber. She taught high school for a decade before becoming a literacy coach, and she's been mentoring first-year teachers at UCLA's School of Education for 20 years. We'll link to Beck's classic Edutopia article about scaffolding in our episode notes. We also want to thank expert teacher Cara Duma for sharing her scaffolding strategy. She actually wrote a whole article for Edutopia with more details about how this works in class. You know where to find the link. We love hearing from you. Send us your stories, ideas, and questions, and let us know what you'd like us to cover in future episodes. Our email is podcasts@edutopia.org. If you liked this episode, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please, leave us a rating and a review. This helps others find our show. This episode was produced by Anne Noisani and edited by me. Our engineer is Doug Keeley, and our supervising editors are Sarah Gonser and Steve Merrill. Special thanks to Yuki Terada. I'm Kristen Leong. We'll see you again soon.